I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Governor Larry Hogan cruised to victory on Tuesday. He's the first Republican governor to be reelected in Maryland since 1954. His fellow Republicans did not fare as well, as Democrats captured county executive seats in Baltimore, Howard, and Anne Arundel counties, and the Republican Drive for Five, an effort to bolster the governor's veto power, fell short. And a court has decided that the state has fallen short when it comes to drawing the district lines for Congress. They've told legislators to fix it, or a commission will fix it for them. WBAL television investigative reporter Jane Miller and the Baltimore Sun's editorial page editor Andy Green join me with analysis of what's next in Maryland politics. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us today. Larry Hogan won big on Tuesday night. Other Republicans also running for re-election? Not so much. Alan Kittleman in Howard County and Steve Shue in Anne Arundel County both lost their re-election bids for county executive. And as David Lublin reports in 7th State, Democrats now hold a majority of seats in county councils and commissions around the state. That includes Baltimore County, where the county council retained a Democratic majority, and Johnny Olszewski Jr., a progressive Democrat, won his race for county executive over Larry Hogan's insurance commissioner and friend, Al Redmer. Republican efforts to establish a veto-proof contingent in the state Senate also fell short. So what does that portend as the General Assembly prepares to take up education, redistricting, and other contentious issues when they reconvene in Annapolis in January? Joining me today in Studio A are two longtime observers of the political landscape in Baltimore and beyond. They are our A-team analysts. Andy Green is the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Jane Miller is an award-winning investigative reporter at WBAL Television. We are streaming our conversation this afternoon from Studio A on Facebook Live. In a little bit, we'll take your phone calls. If you want to drop us an email, we're at midday@wipr.org. You can also send us a tweet at @midday_wipr. Welcome back. Good to see you both.
Thanks, Tom.
So yesterday, you all were nice enough to come over, and we sat here in this very
nice
studio.
Chat.
Yeah, had a very nice chat for a couple of hours. None of us thought to press the record button. We, of course, were preempted yesterday because of President Trump and Congresswoman Pelosi's joint press conference, separate press conferences. Andy, let me start with you. What do we take from the victory in solid fashion of Larry Hogan and the fact that so many other Republicans did not fare as well?
I think we take that Larry Hogan is a very, very good politician, that he has been positioning himself for this reelection very diligently for at least 2 years, arguably longer than that. He did not let up for one second, no matter how far ahead he appeared to be in the polls. It was almost as if he was trying to chase the Schaefer reelect numbers. You know, I don't know if he's like Schaefer going to go around the state trying to find all the people who didn't vote for him. But, you know, he certainly seems to have been very focused on this. And with everything he did in terms of how he positioned himself on issues like fracking, like healthcare, like criminal justice, to how he worked to manage his relationship or lack thereof with President Trump. He really played this about as well as you possibly could for any candidate, much less a Republican candidate in Maryland.
Yeah, and Jane, it really was an expertly run campaign. He picked up voters in every jurisdiction from 2014. He got 28% of the vote in Prince George's County, 31% in the city of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, these would just be unheard of numbers for a Republican candidate for governor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a lot to unpack in the governor's race. You had a Democratic nominee who is definitely of the Bernie Sanders mold. And obviously, what did 2016 tell us in the presidential race is that Maryland wasn't going to support a Bernie Sanders candidate. So,
yeah, Hillary Clinton won that
primary. In some ways, you know, maybe some of the Democrats are going to say, come on, Jane. But I kind of look at Hogan and Hillary as from the Democratic, from the kind of
two
old establishment. Yeah, I mean, they kind of see the same person. I was talking to Malia Cromer yesterday from Goucher, who does a lot of the polling and everything else, and she says, look, Larry Hogan is his own brand, which gets us to why, you know, there were no coattails or very thin, short coattails. But I just think the Democrats have, and this, what I see in the Maryland race is this kind of portends what the Democrats are up against nationally going into 2020 is who's the nominee? Is it an establishment type candidate that is a more moderate Democrat?
Or Joe Biden kind of guy.
Yeah, or, you know, some others that would fit that mold. A Kamala Harris could easily fit that mold, but I don't know. I think that's
Kamala
what
Harris
up
probably
against.
More identified with the progressives, the so-called
yeah,
progressive
it will be,
wing.
But I'm telling you
the
what,
party.
They're losing. That, yeah, but, I mean, but know, so, at what, some point we'll have that conversation.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
But you know, so we have a progressive candidate, Stacey Abrams in Georgia, who's hanging on by a thread. I mean, mm-hmm. maybe there's a runoff there. I mean, they're in court figuring that mm-hmm. out now. Andrew Gillum in Florida, another progressive candidate, did not fare well. Came close, but didn't fare mm-hmm. well.
They are faring well in House races.
Yeah.
Which again are those much more concentrated areas of voters, but I think that it does raise the Maryland race really raises some of those questions. Now, also, what I was going to say is that coming out of the gate, you had a contentious Democratic primary with multiple candidates. You had the death of a candidate, so Jealous had to spend a lot of money. Everybody had to spend money. Jealous wins that, and he comes out. I think he had $260,000 in the bank. Mm-hmm. As you head into the general,
and Hogan had about 9
eight,
million.
He yeah, had 8.2 yeah. or something like that. And yeah. and what comes next? Next, you have the RGA. Not even Hogan, not even spending the money. The RGA puts up that first
ad. The Republican Governor Association, they spent $4 million defining Ben Jealous in the yeah.
as a yeah. an extremist, a socialist, angry black man. That's exactly what that ad did, right?
Yeah.
And before Jealous could even blink, that ad is on television
yeah,
in the summer.
And Andy, what about the whole notion of party identification? I mean, Ben Jealous's strategy was there's twice as many Democrats right. as Republicans. If I can get a million of them to come out and vote along party lines, we can easily beat this guy.
Yeah, he had a great strategy for the primary, which was to take the Bernie voters and do better with African-American voters than Bernie did. That worked. It did not work in a general election against a Republican candidate with huge crossover appeal.
Yep.
And the other thing, you know, getting back to the primary is, you know, this was not like 2006 when the last time we had a Republican running for reelection and you had two really obvious, strong Democratic candidates in Martin O'Malley. And if he didn't work out, Doug Duncan, and mm-hmm. turns out Doug Duncan had to drop out of the race for health reasons. But, the party was completely united at that point around Martin O'Malley, and there was a burning urge on the part of party leaders to get rid of Bob Ehrlich. There was no burning urge to get rid of Larry Hogan. In fact,
no, the
as
reverse.
Far as the party leaders were
enjoying,
that's right.
who enjoyed 30-35% support among Democrats.
Yeah, and if we were to somehow be able to sneak into the ballot booth with Mike Miller, with Mike Bush, with a bunch of these other guys in Annapolis,
exactly
and look
right.
at look
Who'd
at what little bubble they marked on their ballot. I would.
So Jay Miller,
I'll leave that to you to speculate.
Yeah,
no, wait,
Mike Miller said that if the Democrats had nominated Rashearn Baker, mm-hmm. it would have turned out differently. Do you think anybody else shares
I
Mr.
Don't know.
Miller's
I
view?
I don't know. Look, I don't know. The reason I say that is because if you look back to 2002, the Democrats have lost 3 of 4 elections with a white woman and 2 black men. Now, Todd Eberle said to me, you know, another political pundit said, they're all bad candidates. I said, look, is this a race gender thing? I don't know. I know that I was at a Maryland Bar Association event about 2 weeks ago, and Tim Maloney was speaking. Remember him?
He's a former delegate, Prince
PG
George's
County.
County.
Mike
Prince
Miller
George's
type.
County.
Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. You know, was chair of the House Appropriations Committee in the early 90s, very powerful Democrat. Now he's a law firm. He's no longer in the legislature. And he was speaking to the group about the legislative session, but was mixing in comments about the governor's race. And he was openly mocking the governor's race, openly joking about how badly Ben Jealous was going to lose. The young lawyer sitting at the table where I was speaking after him, so I was just kind of listening to it, and they were just rolling their eyes. They're like, who is this guy?
Although, you know? At the same time, you had, Johnny Olszewski, fairly progressive mm-hmm. candidate in Baltimore County, did not really associate his campaign with Ben Jealous particularly at all. In
Even
fact,
though he
Al Redmer tried to. I mean, his
stuff.
Opponent Al
yes,
Redmer
correct.
Tried to, you know, sort yeah. of paint Olszewski mm-hmm. and Jealous in the same.
Yeah, there was no sense that it was the Jealous Olszewski team in the way that it was the Hogan Redmer team in Baltimore County. Johnny O ran his own race, and you know, in a normal environment, you would see, you know, if everybody's playing on the same page, they would have been much more closely associated in a pivotal county like that, and they just weren't.
Yeah, I mean, Johnny Olszewski won his primary by 17 votes. He
yeah,
won
right,
his
exactly
general
right.
election by 14
yeah,
points.
Very
I mean, you know,
well,
this
he's also
is huge.
He's also a native of the county. He's a native of Dundalk, at that very red part of the county, but that's where he comes from. He's familiar in the eastern part of Baltimore County. And you know, your strategy there is just to pick off enough votes to kind of mitigate, you know, yeah. how conservative that part of the county is.
And then
is,
to run up
know.
The score in the western
Absolutely.
Part of the
county. Absolutely. That's how yeah. you run. That's how you win that race. I, you know, without that name recognition, I don't know if the Democrat could do that.
And,
you,
well,
you know?
And on the governor's side, the strategy is supposed to be to run up the score in Baltimore
yep.
City, Montgomery
yep.
County, and Prince George's
right.
County,
yeah.
where Mr. Hogan did very, very well.
And mm. so it's correct. Exactly right. Yeah. Well, again, you get to that whole kind of brilliant. Look, Larry Hogan spent more $1.1 million. It's more. I mean, we haven't seen the latest finance report, so it's going to be more than that. But through mid-October, he had spent $1.1 million on internal polling. Throughout the course of his term, and most of it in the past year, that's way higher than we've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. You know,
in
to
Maryland.
Put it in context,
he wants
folks,
to keep
the statewide poll costs about $12,000.
Yeah,
well,
so $1.41 million can buy a whole lot of polls.
He yeah. was by who's spent had a lot of $36,000 expenses in that category. So that,
yeah.
but it's yeah. it was a constant amount of polling that was internal polling that was going on. So. Yeah, he had a pretty good sense, I think, of what people were going to, you know, respond to.
He's only the second Republican governor in history in Maryland to be reelected. He gave a press conference yesterday talking about his priorities for the coming term. He talked a little bit about this in the campaign. He's talking about a tax cut, and he's talking about redistricting.
Yeah.
Yesterday afternoon, just after the three of us left each other, a court order, Andy Green, told Maryland that 2020 is too long to wait to fix the redistricting problem in Maryland. What did they order
well, so
the folks to
they
do?
Ruled that the this case specifically centered around the 6th district, which used to be a Republican Western Maryland district, was changed after the last round of redistricting to give Democrats a better chance, which they took advantage of, first with John Delaney and now with David Trone in that seat. They did this by taking out some of the rural voters and sprinkling them around other Democratic districts.
Elijah Cummings got some of them.
Yeah, and the Van Hollen, now Jamie Raskin seat, got some of them. And so anyway, now this district...
Yeah, and folks should understand, it includes Frederick County and Montgomery County.
Yes. I mean,
and Western Maryland.
And Western Maryland. Very yeah. disparate places.
And so these 6th district voters argued that they were... disenfranchised by this process, that they were discriminated on the basis of their political beliefs. The court accepted that argument, said this district has to change. And so the state has a pretty tight deadline to turn around new maps that the court will find acceptable. The court has strongly suggested that the state put together an independent commission to do this, which is something that Larry Hogan has been trying to do, and we at the Sun editorial board have also been on his side on this one for several years, and has not gotten the time of day from Democrats in the General Assembly. So we'll see if things change now. You know, there are ways theoretically you could fix this problem by only affecting a couple of districts, but it's also possible you wind up with a domino effect that changes more. And more broadly, you know, this is just going to be in effect for one election for 2020, and then new lines will be in effect for 2022. But it does raise the question, if we're going to do it in some theoretically fair process now, how can we go back to the old ways 2 years later?
Yeah, and the court has given a 4-month deadline. So
yes.
The legislature has to figure something out by March. And of course, then in 2020, there is a census. Governor Hogan will be in office to oversee the redistricting based on the census, you know, moving 10 years forward. But as you say, Andy, I mean, if they get it right this time, there'd be no reason to change it. But Ben Jealous even
There is a reason to change it if you're Mike Miller and you want to have as many Democrats in Congress as possible. But from a good government standpoint, no.
And it was considered a gaffe on the part of Ben Jealous, who mentioned at a Democratic Party meeting during the campaign that he was going to, you know, maintain a 7-1.
He was going to go for 8-0.
Yeah, he was going to go for 8-0.
His point was that unless you do this around the country with all these Republican gerrymandered districts, and there are many of them.
Yeah.
Yes, unilateral disarmament, Mike Miller's argument as well against it. He says if Jersey and Pennsylvania and Virginia and everybody else does it, we'll do it too.
Right.
Larry Hogan is saying, again, it's one of his common sense solutions that have a commission and just make it fair.
Yeah. Yes, and our argument has been you don't get to the right place by doing the wrong thing.
Exactly. We will come back and hopefully do the right thing a little bit more for the rest of our hour with Jane Miller. She leads the investigative team at WBAL Television, and Andy Green. He is the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Quick break. We'll take your calls and comments when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Stick around. We will be right back. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the Midday News Wrap, we'll take a look at results from the midterms across the country, the resignation of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, and the ramifications of Congress splitting power between the House and the Senate. Plus, Marion Winnick. We'll talk about her new collection of essays called The Baltimore Book of the Dead. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review King of the Yees at Baltimore Center Stage. That's all coming up tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about the results of Tuesday's election here in Maryland with Andy Green, the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun, and Jane Miller. She is WBAL Television's lead investigative reporter. Our phone number at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's grab a phone call. Charles, welcome to Midday with Jane Miller and Andy Green.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to make a comment about why I think Governor Hogan was reelected by such a significant majority, and it's because, in fact, he actually does represent the views of the vast majority of Marylanders who are relatively fiscally conservative and who are socially pretty darn moderate. And, you know, I think most Marylanders really don't care whether you are a Democrat or you're a Republican. If you are a fiscal, generally responsible person and you're going to let people live their lives the way they want to live their lives, you're going to get their votes.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Charles. I appreciate it. So, Andy, maybe this is just a case of a progressive candidate like Ben Jealous just not being in step with this particular state. But if you're going to pick a progressive state, you would think that Maryland might be certainly more progressive than, say, for example, Georgia, Stacey Abrams.
Well, certainly true. You know, I would say that Ben Jealous didn't do a great job of, and, you know, maybe didn't get much of an opportunity because he was on his heels from the beginning, to really make a case for some of the progressive things that he was pitching, Medicare for all or free college, you know, these sorts of things. You know, in fact, even we on the generally sort of liberal Sun's editorial board were like, hey, wait a minute, you have not made the case for this stuff and how it would work in Maryland. And, you know, Governor Hogan's entire promise from the time he began running for his first term 4 years ago was, I'm going to get the fiscal situation in Annapolis in order, I'm going to be pro-business, and I'm not going to touch abortion, not going to touch guns, not going to touch gay rights. And he has pretty much stuck to that. Mm-hmm. And there is not a whiff of that in this term. He's, in fact, you know, done in office. He actually supported a couple of gun control measures. So, you know, I think he has, you know, if he does have any inclination to address those issues, he's buried it really deep. But, you know, frankly, it just doesn't, you know, from my interactions with him, it just does not seem to animate
him. Well, he might get his chance. because it'll be interesting. He has not had to say a word about gay marriage, marriage equality, abortion rights, gun control. All of that has already been dealt with at the ballot box in this state by voters, those issues. But with what's going on in Washington with the Supreme Court and the decided tilt to the right, I mean, as we speak, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is in the hospital with broken ribs.
And she fell in her office last
night.
That's correct.
I mean, this could, you can foresee a time coming when some of these issues may get resurrected through different decisions that get made by the Supreme Court that come back to the states, and then governors are going to have to deal with them. And
right. You legislators. Saw, for example, this year, House Speaker Mike Bush saying, hey, we need to put essentially a state version of Roe v. Wade in the Constitution.
As a constitutional man. And Governor Hogan has not said he was opposed to that. He said if that's something people want to do, then he'd be okay with it. I mean,
well,
it
he may
kind of a lukewarm endorsement.
Have a chance to. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know.
And
this is purely speculative,
sure, of course.
But yes.
He made, you know, Mr. Hogan made the case that bipartisanship is what people are looking for. They're not looking for the sort of rancor and political polarity that we see in Washington. But Mr. Hogan, as Andy mentioned, you know, the top of the show, is a very deft politician, and he knows who's for him and who's against him. And he did have this thing that they called Drive for Five, which is to elect five more Republican senators, which would inoculate a veto. It would essentially make Governor Hogan's vetoes sustainable. And he vetoed a number of pieces of legislation, paid family leave, some new energy proposals, stuff like that, that the legislature overrode. He also went after a Republican or two. There's an incumbent Senator Steve Waugh, who occasionally voted to override Mr. Hogan's vetoes, and Mr. Hogan gave money to Mr. Waugh's primary candidate, primary opponent, to make sure that Mr. Waugh didn't return to the legislature. So he knows who's for him and who's not, and he's not afraid to go after him if they're not for him.
Well, but voters did not go along with that plan about the Drive for Five, et cetera, and elsewhere. I mean, you know, as we sat here on as Monday dawned this week, there were two Republican county executives, one in Anne Arundel County and one in Howard County, surrounding the city of Baltimore. And today, as we speak, they're both Democrats. They flipped. And that happened in other some of the House seats, et cetera. In old chef Johnny O in Baltimore County, while that was an open seat, was
and
able
Jan
to
Gardner
handle
and
it.
Jan Gardner and Frederick
yes,
retained her
absolutely.
Seat.
Yeah. Yep, that's yeah. right. So it was as if voters went to the poll and said, oh, that's Larry Hogan, but I'm voting Democratic the rest of the way. And that's probably a little bit of the Trump backlash that's involved here. Also that, you know, we're in a state that, you know, we have pretty well-educated voters in many places, too, and they know that the Democrats dominate the legislature, which is the checks and balance of having a Republican
right.
governor.
Nicholas emails, I think Hogan got reelected because none of his policies passed the Democratic-held legislature.
Well, that may well be true.
My point.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
to my point. Right.
Let's also say that, you know, he talked about 4 years ago, oh, I'm going to roll back all these O'Malley tax increases. No, he has not.
He lowered the toll.
Yeah,
it's cheaper to go across the bridge now and you don't have to
dollar.
Pay for your easy pass.
You know, did he try to roll back income tax increases? No. Did he try to roll back the sales tax increase? No. Actually, Ben Jealous proposed rolling
but,
back
you know,
the sales tax
increase.
Let's talk
about this side of this whole Maryland open for business. You know, there's been a lot written about, you know, that it hasn't been a really stellar performance, and that Maryland hasn't been able to, it lost discovery. It looks like Amazon HQ2 is going to go to Virginia, New York, the way it appears right now, not Montgomery County, which made the final cut. Baltimore never even made the top 20. There hasn't been soaring economic investment.
Mr. Hogan is not known
you know?
As an activist governor either. He's
no,
known
correct.
For
hitching
his wagon to some Democratic proposals, like the lockbox education, which passed overwhelmingly, 89%.
Yeah, essentially, the Democrats have been driving most of the policy, or much of the policy anyway, for the last 4 years in a way that we as Marylanders are not really accustomed to. We're used to governors, you know, driving the bus. Larry Hogan is more like the driver's ed instructor who occasionally hits the second brake, you know?
Right.
Andy exactly. Green of the Baltimore Sun, Jane Miller of WBAL Television. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can find us on Twitter, @MiddayWYPR. I got a bunch of calls. Let's go to Deirdre in Frederick County. Deirdre, welcome to Midday with Jane Miller and Andy Green.
Thank you. I just have three comments to make about Frederick County. First, I think YPR does not really report on the politics in Frederick very much. For example, Jan Gardner, our very wonderful executive for our county, was reelected, and she's a Democrat.
Yep, just mentioned that a minute ago, huh?
The other thing is, as far as redistricting in Frederick County goes, I really feel like I have more in common with Montgomery County than I do with Garrett County. Such issues as immigration, transportation, schools, overcrowding, and also, you know, what is the economic powerhouse of Frederick County? It's still thought to be rural, but cross the line and see how suburban it has become.
Oh, it is a Washington suburb. There's no question.
Frederick
no
is
question.
Really, I think, a county divided.
Absolutely.
The part of the county that the caller is talking about that's really just plugged right into Montgomery County and D.C.
Yep. Right up 270. Yep.
There is still a big rural part of the county that it is more western Maryland. It's a very divided jurisdiction, I think she's
Yeah,
she's
and there's a big difference between downtown Frederick
what
and
was the,
10
in the,
miles
with
out.
The yeah. old District 6... Where was Frederick County? Was it in the...
Yeah, it was in 6.
It was in
Western
6,
Maryland,
right.
Yeah.
And, of course, David Trone, who won that race, spent $16 million getting himself elected. The last time he ran in a different district. He ran in the 8th district. He lost to Jamie Raskin in the primary. He spent $14 million of his own money in that race. Had a cancer diagnosis, which he received a day before the primary. Has received treatment for that and seems to be doing okay. He doesn't even live in the district. And you don't have to live in the district in Maryland.
It's generally good form to live in the district, but you don't have to.
He just wanted to be in Congress. He didn't even care what district, it sounds like. And, you know, he's spent $30 million getting himself elected to Congress. So we wish him the best of luck. Let's go to Joe in Baltimore. Joe, welcome to Midday.
Hey, thank you. I'm going to tell Jane Miller, I love and respect her. She's a great, she does a lot of great work in keeping us informed about lots of things around Baltimore. So. But I wanted my comment, and Jane Miller made
And then it's going to be
comment,
but.
okay. You made a comment earlier about the past three losers, two black men and one woman.
Correct.
And I think if our country and if our state is to move forward in this, I guess this dream of America, we have to start talking about the fact of, you know, of race and try and not. I know it has some psychological. Impacts on us, but if I look back and it's a mature conversation, and we have to be calm about it. But I'm looking at the qualification of Anthony Brown versus Hogan.
Yeah,
you know that doesn't. And then in this election, Ben Jealous in this kind of Democratic wave. It's hard for me to believe if Ben Jealous hadn't with the same ideas hadn't been a white man, he would have won. Slightly, you know, it wouldn't have been just so I think it's hard, but we do have to talk about race and gender, because I think because we know what's happening in our country too with the president now.
Sure.
You know, his opponent was way much more qualified, but she didn't win.
Yeah.
So,
Joe, do you think Ben Jealous was a better candidate than Anthony Brown?
Between those two
candidates, which one do you think ran the stronger race against Larry Hogan? Neither of them were successful, but do you think that there was one that was better than the other?
I think Anthony Brown, just his credentials and him having been there before and his background and his just the kind of person he was.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well,
those simple things like that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the comment.
Let's be honest here. There has long been this kind of whispered about, you know, don't say it publicly, but whispered about that a black candidate cannot win statewide in the state of Maryland. That's not new. Mm-hmm. And I bring that up because you just kind of look at it and to write it off as, oh, they were bad candidates. Well, that's, I think, a more complicated issue than that. And I agree with Joe. I think this is a conversation. You look at Florida statewide, Georgia statewide. I mean, I'm very familiar with both of those states. And Atlanta's one thing and the rest of Georgia's another.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Big time. Yeah. It's a tough thing in these statewide races for candidates of color and women in many cases to succeed.
Yeah, Congress will have 30 women added
correct.
To their ranks, including two Muslim Americans, two mm-hmm. Native Americans, and Andy Green, one of the members of the Maryland congressional delegation, Elijah Cummings, who also won his race easily for reelection, will now, because the Democrats control Congress, will now have a very, very large role on the national
yes.
stage.
Although I should point out that, yes, 30 more women are coming to Congress nationwide, but Maryland is contributing precisely zero women
correct.
In mm-hmm. its congressional delegation.
Even with a long history of many correct. Women in the congressional delegation.
Yeah. yeah. And so, you know, I think the party needs to consider how well it's supporting these candidates going forward, because there are, on the benches, there are some very good people out there. There's Angela Alsobrooks, the new county executive in Prince George's County. You know, she
ran as a Democrat unopposed.
Yes, she's you know, very, very well regarded. Calvin Ball, who just won in Howard County, is a terrific mm-hmm. Terrific elected official and could be a good candidate for higher office later. You know, I think Krish Vigniraja impressed a lot mm-hmm. of people
in her run for governor.
You know, there are people out there who could be this next generation.
There's definitely a new generation. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Calvin Ball. I do want to mention Alan Kittleman, the current county executive of Howard County, went over to Mr. Ball's headquarters on election night mm-hmm. and conceded that race in person. There's a photograph of the two of them giving each other a hug. I got to tell you, I interviewed both of those gentlemen during the campaign. They are both extraordinary, thoughtful, magnanimous people, and I thought Mr. Kittleman's move on election night was a particularly classy act.
It's you do have to choose civility, as they say in Howard County, and they did. It's not something that happens automatically. It takes people who are willing to work at it. And, you know, Alan Kittleman and Calvin Ball, I know both of them are terrific. You know, Howard County has had this embarrassment of riches of good candidates for local office there. The county executive
on both sides of the aisle.
Both sides of the aisle have been terrific. You know, last election, Courtney Watson ran against Alan Kittleman. She was great. She won a seat in the House of Delegates this time, so we're certainly very happy to see her back in public office. You know, it's a great example. We've seen this to some degree elsewhere. You know, Chris West in District 42, the new state senator, Republican, who's replacing Jim Brochin, also sent out a really kind of heartfelt email about his Democratic opponent, Robbie Leonard, with a picture of the two of them kind of laughing together about, you know, how he was really happy with what a great constructive campaign they ran on both sides and hoping to work together in the future. So, you know, for all the toxicity in Washington, there are people out there.
Yeah, again, Al Redmer and Johnny Olszewski ran a very civil campaign focused on the issues. They had some definite disagreements on issues.
And some kind of sketchy attack ads here and there, but
But generally,
think that it really kind of marred that sense in Maryland were those RGA ads that were just really very harsh
and constructed in a way, you know, in whatever the visual equivalent of a dog whistle is.
It is. Yeah. No, there's no question. I mean, those were those, you know, outside group spending, et cetera. And it was right out of the gate. That's what I mean.
$4 million that Mr. Hogan certainly didn't disavow. But back to take a quick break. But Andy Green, Elijah Cummings, he is now going to be the likely chair of the Oversight Committee in Congress. What do you think we can expect?
Subpoenas.
By the bucket.
Yeah.
By the bucket full. All right, we'll talk about that and some more stuff
when we come back.
We will. Jane Miller is the lead investigative reporter at WBAL Television. Andy Green, the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. More analysis when we come back after a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @midday WYPR. You can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. And before we go to a break, a shout out to the novelist Alice McDermott, who lives in Silver Spring and teaches at Johns Hopkins University. She has been awarded the Prix Femina for her novel The Ninth Hour. That's a big award in France for the best foreign novel. She joins the likes of E.M. Forster and Virginia Woolf in receiving this honor. I'm a big fan of Alice's work and this novel in particular, and all of us at Midday send our congratulations to Alice McDermott for being recognized in this important way. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. More than 2 million voters cast a ballot on Tuesday. That's about double the number that voted for Larry or voted in Larry Hogan's first run for governor. And in 2020, we may very well have redrawn congressional districts. As we mentioned earlier, yesterday afternoon, a federal court ordered the state to put new lines on the map by March of next year. So if legislators can't make that deadline, the court will establish a commission to do the job for them. If you've just joined us, we're talking politics with Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun and Jane Miller of WBAL Television. 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. You can drop us a tweet at Midday WIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Let's go to Christian in Bolton Hill. Christian, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
Doing great. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm that very rare breed. I'm a Republican that lives inside Baltimore City, and I am
more of you than you think.
it's lonely. Yeah. But especially with redistricting coming up, is there a possibility of someone who is at least a little bit more to the right on the spectrum receiving a city council spot or a part of it? I know that there are Democrats outnumber Republicans in Baltimore by about 9-1 is the last figure that I had.
Yep.
But I also know that there are more seats on the council than that, and that, to be honest, a little bit of a different voice on the council might behoove Baltimore. There are cities across the country that have had a much greater degree of success than Baltimore has of late in terms of both business acquisition and turning things around. By having a myriad of voices.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm very aware that the regrettable incidents on the national stage associated with Republicans are a turnoff for many Baltimoreans, but there's more to it than that, I assure everybody.
Yeah, well, thanks for the call, Christian. It's also should be noted, as many others have noted before, Baltimore County, for example, has a population of nearly 900,000 people.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Baltimore City has a population of 600,000 mm-hmm. people. The county council in mm-hmm. Baltimore County is 7 people.
Mm-hmm.
In Baltimore City, it's 14 people.
Mm-hmm. Plus the president.
Plus the president. So it's
correct.
Actually
And the president
15
is a
members.
Citywide elected position where in many cities
the mayor.
It's well, the chair of the council president or the chair of the council is appointed by the members.
Yeah,
it's not this, separate elected whatever.
So as Calvin Ball was, for example, in Howard County. Yeah, but
to the
Andy, what do you
question,
think?
The issue in Baltimore City is not so much partisan gerrymandering because partisanship is not the issue in Baltimore because the Democratic numbers are so overwhelming. However, in the Southeast Baltimore district, now represented by Zeke Cohen, there is a pretty substantial population down there willing to vote Republican. There were strong Republican candidates.
Larry Hogan carried that first councilmanic district both in 2014 and again.
Yep. Substantially.
And there were strong Republicans running in that district in the last election. So if there's a place...
A Hogan-backed candidate ran in that council race mm-hmm. in 2016.
Yeah,
yes.
So the caller may need to move from Bolton Hill to Canton, but there is a possibility out there. Of course, Mr. Cohen has been a pretty good and active councilman, so,
also to the caller,
harder to get rid of, but yeah.
Some of the members of the council are more conservative than others. I always say the two parties in Baltimore are Democrats and disgruntled Democrats. So
yeah.
there are some that have more... I mean, Eric Costello, for example, is very pro-business council person.
Yeah, or Yitzi Schleifer, my councilman in Northwest Baltimore, mm-hmm. is pretty conservative.
Yeah. So,
I think also people were expecting a lot more upheaval in the council with this new class of young council members. I mean, there were eight new members of the council in the last councilmanic election. I think people had expectations that things were going to get kind of blown up. I think Jack Young has not let things blow up all that much, and it's interesting that the council. I think a lot of people have been disappointed that things haven't been revolutionized in the way that people might have had some expectations. But you're right, Andy. I don't think the redistricting is going to really affect. Although, for this court order to go into effect, it seems impossible to envision a scenario where they can just change the sixth district without changing at least two or three others, if not the whole.
Well, the city has part of the third. The second and the seventh. Right, yeah. There's three.
Dutch Ruppersberger, Elijah Cummings, and John Sarbanes all have constituents in the city.
The sixth is the least sprawling all over the place, or one of them.
Yeah, probably the first district, which is the Eastern Shore one, is the closest to rational.
And in that race, which was gerrymandered by Democrats 10 years ago to put many Republicans
pack them
in
there. Jesse
Colvin, a young 34-year-old first-time candidate, military veteran, ran, I thought, a very strong campaign. Didn't win. Harris
didn't particularly come close.
Yeah, Andy Harris won, by a landslide, actually. But what do you think? I mean, is his argument is the argument of a lot of people. It was the argument of a lot of people who ran for city council and even for delegate. It's time for a new generation. It's time for a generational change. I wonder how that affects somebody like Steny Hoyer, who, of course, was reelected and is now poised to be part of the Republican leadership.
Well, if you look at the Democratic leadership, yes.
But, I'm sorry, excuse me, yes.
I mean, the Democratic leadership is, definitely of an older generation by and large. You've got Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, also a Baltimorean, but not currently. Steny Hoyer, James Clyburn, these are folks who are, I don't know how to put it politely, but of an older generation.
Right, the older guard, right? Yeah. Old guard Democrats.
And now we've got a tremendous amount, the youth vote was way up in this election compared to what it is in a typical midterm. There are a lot of kind of dynamic young candidates who succeeded and are coming into the House, and you wonder how long the Democrats can keep this group of people in charge. The Republicans have actually, I think, done a much better job over the years of cycling newer blood into their leadership ranks, most recently with House Speaker Paul Ryan, but, there have been plenty of other examples over the years. It'll be interesting to see whether Democrats kind of catch on to that as being an imperative.
Yeah, and the one thing that we started to talk about this before we went to the break about when you ask what's Elijah Cummings going to do, and Andy's answer was subpoena. The Democrats are going to be really careful with their newfound power and newfound clout.
And this is what Nancy Pelosi was saying yesterday. She was saying
we're going to talk about impeachment.
Very,
right. Because
we're going to be careful.
You know exactly what's going to happen here. The market's going to dip 400 points and Trump's going to blame the Democrats in Congress. He's going to blame, he can't get anything done because they're picking at him. And it's going to be a constant.
A voter in Ohio stubs his toe and
yes,
the Democrats
exactly
will
right.
be at fault.
Will Pelosi be reelected speaker?
I think she will. Should she is the other question.
Kevin McCarthy has announced on the Republican side that he is definitely running for minority leader. That's not surprising to anybody.
That's an open seat since Paul Ryan is leaving.
Right.
Yeah.
But, a lot of people ran, including Mr. Colvin, who said, if I'm elected to Congress, I will not vote for Pelosi for Speaker. If there is going to be a generational change, you think it's going to happen in the next 2 years, or is it going to be a 5 or 10 year process?
I suspect, knowing the way the Democratic Party works, it is going to take a lot of pain before they get to making that kind of choice.
Yeah, Dianne Feinstein, who's 85 years old, elected, by the end of her term, she'll be 91 years old, 92, I guess, by the time the term actually completes. Interesting. Let's go to Dan in Charles Village. Dan, thanks for calling Midday. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'd just like to say that I think the reason why the Democrats do so poorly for the last several elections, like with Gillis and with Kennedy Townsend and with Brown, is because they've ran lousy campaigns. I just don't understand why that's being underestimated. It's not a coronation. It's a campaign, and that's what you do in war. You have a campaign. And if you're going to treat it like a coronation, then this is the result you're going to get. I mean, what kind of campaign did Jealous run? I don't even know what the guy stands for. You call him a progressive. What does that mean? You know, I mean, the average person, I mean, people were saying that the average person in Baltimore doesn't even have even heard of this guy before.
All right, well, thanks for the call, Dan.
Where's the rallies? Where's the campaigns? Where's the billboards? He says he has no money. Well, that's no excuse.
All right, well, thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. I mean, Ben Jealous would describe himself as a progressive. He was for Medicare for all as an approach to health care. He was for free college tuition. He was for a $15 minimum wage. You know, he had the support of a number of unions behind him, and Mr. Hogan also had some unions as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Dan's comment is a comment that I heard a lot during the campaign from callers who were saying, you know, the Jealous campaign is invisible. We just didn't see them. Is that, Andy Green, just a function of money?
I think the coronation argument applies more to Kennedy, Townsend, and Brown. I think in Jealous's case, you know, he had some good people working for him in the campaign, people who know Maryland politics and who have done this before. But, you know, I know you say, you may say money is not an excuse, but it's all important in politics to be able to get your name and your message out there. But no, I would not say they ran anything close to an energetic, organized, disciplined campaign. They were slow to jump on issues sometimes. They, you know, Mr. Jealous made some kind of unfortunate gaffes. You know, and I would say, as someone who has had the opportunity to sit down with him a number of times over the years, you know, to sit down and chat with the guy who's, you know, a Rhodes Scholar, for Pete's sake, former chairman of the NAACP, here's this really impressive, accomplished guy that somehow just didn't manage to get that across in the medium of a campaign.
And the thing is, he was a first-time candidate. He was a first-time candidate, too. I mean,
and
of course, in 2014, Larry Hogan was like a second-time candidate.
Correct.
He had run for Congress once, but he grew up in a political household. His father was in Congress. Mr. Hogan tried to paint himself as a non-politician, just a, you know, an all shucks business guy. But as we've seen, he's a very astute politician.
What did Larry Hogan do to appeal to Baltimore City voters? He ran two ads. Three, actually. There were three ads that involved black people in Baltimore, black residents of Baltimore.
Endorsing him.
Absolutely. Talking about what, you know, one was a businesswoman. The first one was a series of that. That's how he captured that increased support in Baltimore City. That's how he appealed better to African Americans. Was he
and as Doug Miles,
campaign ads,
as Bishop, you know? Doug Miles of the Koinonia Baptist Church and Build said, I think black voters have reason to be disenchanted with
the
Democrats have let them down.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So it's kind of a perfect storm, you know. And they were black voters in Baltimore City are definitely, you know, they were there for the taking in terms of Hogan really trying to reach out to them. However, and again, I think he did it mostly through his advertising, but but absolutely because of the, you know, the disinvestment in the city of Baltimore and a lot of disillusionment.
Let's go to Clarence in New Freedom. Clarence, we just got about 30 seconds. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you, Jane Miller, for what you do. This is in reference to the expansion of 270 in Montgomery County. Why aren't we hearing a lot about that? And how many homes are going to be lost?
All right, thanks for that call. Andy?
Well, it's not just that. Governor Hogan has a lot of highway widening and building projects in that neck of the woods. The Beltway, 270-95, BW Parkway. And he has made grand announcements, but you're absolutely right. There's a lot of details there about.
Well, and also they're told. They're going to be financed mostly through tolls. Correct.
And again, one of the big differences between Ben Jealous and Larry Hogan was their approaches to transportation. Yeah. Larry Hogan clearly
a road guy,
and not a public transit guy. Ben Jealous not. But the voters voted for that. So the chance of transit coming to downtown Baltimore, for example, or other jurisdictions, not so hot. Just have a little bit of time left, Jane. I'll give you the last word here. The sort of the future of progressivism writ large, nationally. Didn't work for Ben Jealous, hasn't worked for Andrew Gillum, may not work for Stacey Abrams in Georgia. What does that tell you?
Well, I said it. You know, this is a state, Maryland is a state that approved gun control, abortion rights, and gay marriage at the ballot box over about a 22-year period. I think this is, I always talk about change being incremental, that it isn't all going to happen at one time. And so I think that's where we are. This election, in some of these House races, progressives won.
Man, And we'll just have to keep an eye on it.
We'll see if they can defend them in 2020.
As the president says, we'll see what happens. All right, Jane Miller of WBAL, Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun, thank you. Muchly appreciate it. Look forward to the next time.
Thanks, Tom.
Lunch today provided by Eddie's of Roland Park. They're Baltimore's gourmet grocer since 1944. Eddie's of Roland Park offers a selection of local gift baskets and Maryland jumbo lump crab cakes that can be shipped anywhere throughout the United States. Details online at eddiesofrolandpark.com. And by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Tomorrow it's the Midday News Wrap. Hope you join us then. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.